Hi, this is Morgan Michael welcoming you to Kindsight 101, the podcast, where you'll hear from world-renowned educational leaders about the mobilizing power of kindness. I believe that we all have an innate need to be seen, heard, and understood. When we dedicate ourselves to kindness, the ripple effects in our schools can be life-changing. Through this podcast, I want to challenge you to question your assumptions, amplify your insight, and embrace a willingness to go beyond the status quo in education. Together, let's learn how to make a big impact, one small act at a time. Some people believe that empathy is intrinsic, something you're either born with or you're not. Well, my guest today believes that all children have the capacity to be kind, compassionate contributors. We just have to be willing to teach them how. You'll come away from this conversation inspired to start the 21-day kindness challenge with a ton of easy-to-implement tips and strategies for the classroom, with lesson ideas and with service-based projects to dig into with your students. Enjoy. Currently having completed her 34th year as a school counselor in Friendswood, Texas, Barbara Gruner has the unique opportunity of growing alongside learners in every age and stage, pre-K through 12th. A passionate, connected educator, Barbara enjoys positively inspiring and influencing change through her high-energy, engaging keynotes and interactive learning sessions. The author of Corner on Character blog and the book What's Under Your Cape, Barbara firmly believes that we have the power to change the world, one kind act at a time. She just recently has taken the leap into consulting work. When she's not working, you can bet Barbara is knitting, baking, writing, reading, walking, gardening, napping, or spending time with her husband and their three children. You can find her on Twitter at Barbara Gruner, Barbara Gruener, on Facebook at What's Under Your Cape, on Pinterest at B Gruner, and by reading her blog, www.corneroncharacter.com. You can also find her on Pinterest at Barb Gruner. For more information, visit my website, smallactbigimpact.com, and search for episode number 17. I want to thank you for the wonderful reviews that you've left for this podcast on iTunes. Your reviews make a big difference in helping other educators find this show. If you think that I'm doing good work here and you'd like others to get inspired and join our 21-day kindness challenge and movement, I'd love it if you would take a minute, head over to iTunes, and leave a review. Thank you so much. It only takes one person tossing one small pebble to ripple kindness out into the world. Before we know, that ripple becomes a wave of compassion that will bathe all of us in a tsunami of love. So your work is really founded in this deep and purposeful concept of kindness. Can you speak a little bit to that?
I feel like it's important that we do kindness on purpose. And so I was really inspired by the Random Act of Kindness movement. But then I thought, well, why would we want it to be random? Random's like pretty cool, but what if we made it intentional? And I started really digging into what was out there, like how do we do service with a purpose to give kids the why, so that we're not just saying, oh, be kind, or that would be a nice thing to do, but to really go deeper and understand why. And then I think it's really important that they understand that kindness truly always comes back to us. And so you kind of get that helper's high, and it creates such a win-win. And like, I love the idea of bathing in a tsunami of kindness, truly.
Me too. And I think that's where I think we're similar in our outlook, is I felt the very same way. I think I had myself experienced that, like you said, the helper's high, or that oxytocin boost that you get when you help somebody else. But the science actually explains that you do get that reciprocal relationship, and it's on a neuroscientific level, which just blew my mind when I learned that. So that was very exciting. And that sort of give and take that you get, and also that witnesses even
are privy to this amazing boost. You know, just by seeing somebody else do something kind, it then in turn has the same effect on you on that chemical level, which is really neat. And I felt the same way about the intentional piece. And I think for me, with the 21-day kindness challenge, it took sort of more of a habit-forming perspective. But like you, I think I really felt that it was important to build in sort of not a one-off approach to it and then one and done, but more this change in the way that we approach our lives and the way that we see one another and the way that we practice being respectful and kind on an everyday, forever basis. So I really appreciate that point. In your book, What's Under Your Cape, you've referenced this superhero ideal, sort of this idea that there are 11 important traits for character development in students. What is your definition of a superhero and how does it relate to the development of character in school children?
So superheroes basically are just those people that come to the rescue, you know, just like come to the rescue. And when I was growing up, I didn't even watch TV, so I didn't really know about superheroes like Marvel or the comics or anything. I was milking cows. But my superheroes were those 4-H leaders and those teachers and those youth group leaders that really just like volunteered their time to mentor us and help us, you know, connect and be involved and grow as people, not only in academics, but also in character. And then I started to equate it with, well, kids can be superheroes too. And you don't have to like have a cape, or you don't have to like have a lot of money or be of huge stature with your reputation or your stance in the community. You only just have to be willing to come to the rescue. And, you know, that might just be smiling at somebody who hasn't gotten a smile yet today, or, you know, the whole pay it forward at the Starbucks. That's super fun. But again, it doesn't even have to involve money, just a handshake or an invitation to sit with me at lunch, or even just a nod. Your eyes can do so much, even just a nod that says you belong here and you matter to me and I see you and you are enough and you're a big deal. And I think that superheroes tend to do that just by coming to the rescue, and everybody's worthy of that rescue, just like everybody's worthy of kindness and love.
Oh, I love that. That really speaks to me. I think that whole idea that not only do we not have to be in this place of grandeur in our life in order to give back, but that really we can start exactly where we're at, which I think is so accessible for children. But it's also that piece that really what you're doing by being kind or even just acknowledging someone, which is really that embodiment of kindness, is that you are acknowledging who they are and that they exist and that they belong. And that is something that's so dear to my heart. And I think when we are brave enough to really bring that up when we're at the grocery store, when we pass colleagues in the hallway, or, you know, even in traffic, when it seems as though we're in these little cars and we're shut off from one another, but really you can make a connection even by looking at someone in a car, how powerful that might be because of the story that they've got going on in their life and all of these struggles that we don't even know that they're fighting. So can you speak a little bit to that, I suppose, that idea that people are struggling in many different ways and that kindness can be an unexpected, not just olive branch, but like a way out for people, or like an opportunity to come out of a difficult struggle or to sort of gain hope from it, I suppose.
Yeah, actually, I think for us, the whole kindness movement started 1 year, probably in 2008, when we were looking for a school theme, and we had done Star Polishers the year prior, and it was really fun to think of the teachers as star polishers, like the kids are the stars and you're throwing them up to twinkle in the sky, and everyone in different shape and size. And it was going to be hard to beat that theme. But we came up with, what if we did ICU, like the letters ICU, like an emergency room kind of with a doctor's theme. But then ICU also said like I, like with my eyes, and then see you. And the focus that year became empathy. And what I've found in my research for kindness is it's got its roots in empathy, because why be kind? You know, empathy kind of gives kindness its why, because you have to see someone else's story to know that they even want or need your kindness before it is really even that meaningful to them. Now, I'm not saying random kindness doesn't mean something. It does, for sure. But when it gains momentum and goes deeper when you can actually do it as a result of something that somebody wants or needs because you've stepped into their story to see them, to really take a look at them and to say, oh my goodness, I see that her mom is in the hospital with cancer. What would I want or need if my mom were in the hospital with cancer? And for kids, that was just seamless to be able to do that because they totally know what they would want or need in that situation. But you had to put it on their heart. You had to teach them because empathy is a pretty big word for a kindergartner, for example. But man, once they get it, they take it and fly. It's unbelievable what kids will do with empathy to compassion to kindness.
I love that. It gives me chills. I know that you, and actually this is wonderful because I wanted to speak to you a little bit about this. So I know that people often use the terms compassion, empathy, and kindness interchangeably. And I know that you've sort of differentiated them so clearly on your blog and in your books. So can you speak to the differences between them?
Right. So as I prepared for a couple of keynotes, I really felt like it was important to kind of delineate. And I think it starts with empathy, and that's stepping into somebody's story. And I equate that kind of with the mindset that you have. Like you have to actually be in an attitude or a mindset of looking for those needs and being willing to be vulnerable enough to step into somebody's story. That elevated empathy then mobilizes compassion, which my understanding of that is like a co-suffering. Like you're willing to not only say, oh, poor baby, or bless his heart, but you're taking it to the heart set, from the mindset to the heart set, and saying, I can do something about that. And so that compassion piece, you're going to kind of embrace what they're going through and feel that with them. And that just leads beautifully into the hands, which is the third in the trilogy of head, heart, and hands. Mindset is the head, heart set is the heart, and then hands, there's your kindness, because now you have a chance to actually put those feelings of empathy and compassion into action. And that's where the superhero comes to the rescue, and kindness, well, basically kindness comes to the rescue to help alleviate the suffering.
You know, as an elementary school teacher, I can imagine that that idea of the head, the heart, and the hands is very, very concrete. And so the kids can really understand the ability to sort of put yourself in somebody else's shoes and then actually feel that feeling and then be able to actually go from feeling that to doing something. And I think sometimes that can be difficult for adults. When we look at the evening news, for example, we can be overwhelmed with empathy and then compassion. And then we're sitting there and we're kind of like percolating in this feeling as though we are living it almost. I mean, not exactly, but I think the doing piece allows us to sort of move forward through that. And I think that's such an important piece, even just for adults. Can you speak to that?
Well, I heard Michelle Borba say once that dormant empathy does no good. And that's that feeling of paralysis or inability to do anything if all you do with that news is get sucked in. And again, kind of that mindset of, oh, those poor people. But the next step, taking that empathy and making it actionable, is what keeps us from, oh gosh, I don't know, going crazy or getting depressed or sucked in. At one point, my sister said, girl, you have to turn off the news because it is like changing who you are. And I thought, I don't have to just turn off the news. I can keep the news on, but I just have to figure out a way to make it actionable so the things that bother me elsewhere don't end up happening in my own community without us, you know, trying to proactively prevent that. And the kindness campaign at a school makes such a huge difference, because you've got kids like habitually doing kind things for each other. So you get this kind of fabric, you know, that just kind of envelops and warms the people as they come in. I've had people say, I want to just pull up a stool and stay in your school. And that is the biggest compliment, because what that says to me is we've got this warm and welcoming thing going on, and it's all empathy, compassion, and kindness based.
Absolutely. And I think that's the piece that's so important. And I think that's the part that gives people hope that, you know, when I've heard from, I think it's Brené Brown, who talks about this difference between hope and despair, and sort of despair is this feeling that of stuckness, where you're going to be stuck in this reality forever with no hope of change, and that hope is really the promise that tomorrow will be different. And so being able to actually be an agent of that change through the good that you do is incredibly empowering, I think, on a fundamental level. I would like to talk a little bit about actionable tips and some ideas, because when I've done the 21-Day Kindness Challenge in schools and launched it, we get very, very excited, and then we have, you know, a lot of different sort of concrete ideas that we can do. But I know that teachers are always looking for new and exciting and different ways of integrating kindness and kindness practice within the classroom, and then within the school, and then also within the community. Can you speak to that a little bit, and maybe give some of our listeners who are teachers or even educational leaders, or parents for that matter, different actionable ways that we can, you know, bring kindness into our lives?
I think the empowerment piece is so important. And so one of my favorite questions, I've got this little kindergartner that lives across the street. Every day I see him, how were you kind today? What did you do to fill somebody's bucket or make them feel special? And it is so fun to watch his little brain and heart just wrestle with that question. And he knows it's coming, because he moved in October. And every day I'm like, hey, Asher, how are you doing? How were you kind today? So that is such a, you know, rather than what happened at school today, that is such a great question for parents and teachers. How will you be kind today? Or what are we going to do to be kind today, to put on their radar? One of my favorite sayings is that kindness knows no calendar. And so I love it when we can morph out of, like, for our school, it's the Great Kindness Challenge. We do that every year. But to not only just get excited for that little moment in time when we're doing these big campaigns, which I feel like have great value, mm-hmm. but to also continue to carry that on. And when kids come to me and they want to be secret agents, you know, they'll come and say, hey, I've got this idea. And instead of like, oh, no, we couldn't, you know, tell me more is so powerful. And so when I get these kids telling me more and they want to like collect books, or they want to, we did a peace garden with kindness rocks in January, and then they wanted to make another school have one. And so all of a sudden we're collecting paint and rocks and quarters so another school can have one. And I think being willing to take chances on those kids when they come to you with a kindness idea is really important. And sometimes that can be really scary, because either they get grandeur or they don't like have a plan. And so you have to really guide them in that. But man, when you let them lead and kind of get out of their way, a lot of times they've got way better kindness, you know, ideas than I do. We had girls, two fifth graders this year, that just wanted to post sticky notes. Like, they got it from the radio, love that sticks. And before I knew it, they had these beautiful sticky notes and they had printed them on a computer. I'm like, how did you do post-its on a computer? But they're so great. And with mm-hmm. these inspirational messages and, you know, some things that I hadn't even heard. And so sometimes, you know, we think we're going to be like, you know, the big ambassador, and it ends up being like, we're just, you know, in a supporting role if we'll let these kids be the superheroes and the kindness ambassadors. They can lead the service learning projects. You can throw two or three things out there, but they're always going to want to help the animals. They're always going to want to help the military. They're always going to want to help the elderly, but you got to ask them. You know, you can't just go, hey, I have a good idea, let's collect bags. Well, you can collect bags and they're going to bring them in, and now you're recycling. But it's better to ask them how we want to celebrate Earth Day. For example, one day a girl came to me and said, I think we should turn off our cars in the car rider line. Well, that's brilliant. Some of our mamas get there at 2:30 and we don't even dismiss till 3:05. Imagine what that does for the earth if you turn off your car. And so then, you know what? Tell me more. How are you going to get the word out? And, you know, is it just like once a week or are we going to do that all the time? And you just throw fire questions at them and they'll take it and run with it.
I just love that too. And I think even the vulnerability of knowing that we don't know everything is really, really important. And that's part of the whole piece around sort of honoring one another within this learning space. I know that inquiry-based learning is really taking off where in our corner of the world, and this idea that, you know, giving kids agency over their own learning. And it sounds as though that's essentially what you're reinforcing, is this idea that we don't have the answers, but you have ideas and I can just lead you to kind of figuring out what that will look like. And I think that has such wonderful applications in the real world, right? And that ability to see themselves as change makers, not just because you've got a plan for them, as you said, to collect bags or to, you know, collect, you know, socks for the homeless or whatever it happens to be, but because they've identified a potential problem in the community and they've found the solution and they've actually put it into effect, which is very, very empowering. So I love that. I think that's wonderful. Are there any favorite projects? I know that you do or that you've been part of this knitting caps for newborn babies and that sort of thing. Are there any projects that have really stuck out in your head that might be inspiring to other teachers or students?
Well, for sure, the knit one, save one, and that's where, I mean, you have to teach a skill like knitting, and then they just go crazy making these baby hats to save a baby's life. And so, again, the purpose and the why, kids helping kids is so, so powerful. One we do every year is Sweets for Our Soldiers, and we ask the families to bake something in their kitchen, bake up some kindness in their kitchen, and it's something that will ship to our soldiers. And so then we'll ask for active duty military for their addresses. And this year we shipped 33 boxes filled with brownies and cookies and bars and then homemade Valentine. So the kids make the Valentine, the kids make the cookies, and the Rotary gives us the money to ship those 33 boxes. So they gave us $500 as a donation to defray the cost of shipping. And the kids love to hear back from the soldiers because it doesn't matter every year how many we adopt, we at least get one letter back. And these men and women who are across the world are thanking us for their hugs from home because they're getting, you know, these children's homemade Valentines and these baked goods, which, you know, they're 10 days old when they get over there, if it takes 10 days to ship, but the guys and girls don't even care. They're just so excited that someone has remembered them and honored them in that way.
I love that.
My most favorite recent one, and we haven't done it yet, but two girls came to me a few weeks ago, and we have to pass through state testing first, unfortunately, but they had the idea. It's called Pick Me, and their little project is going to be, they want everybody to pick one flower in their garden and bring it to school one day. And then after school, they want to take it to the local nursing home. So of course I had some questions because, you know, maybe there are some allergies or maybe how do the flowers stay wet all day? Like we had some questions, but right now they are home working with their moms or significant caregivers to figure out how that's going to work. And so before school's over, we're going to make these bouquets and take them to a retirement. It's called Hope Village. So it's actually like adult people with Down syndrome or some other cognitive challenge. So it's not necessarily elderly, but they're all ages. But these girls are so excited about their idea and their Flower Power project.
I love that. I think that's the sweetest thing. That gave me chills actually when you said that. And I think those are the types of stories that people sort of attach themselves to and get inspired by, because whether or not it's flowers or something else, I think that's the kind of stuff that really inspires even more ideas. This, again, this ripple effect of ideas. I know that in December, we did a project where we did some art for seniors living in a variety of different senior centers that were not, you know, that were state funded. So, you know, may or may not have had a ton of family support and visits. And so, you know, loneliness can set in. And we talked about that a little bit. And they wanted to do the art to sort of brighten up the walls. And we got a letter back with all of these signatures and comments from the people at the senior center saying how much it had meant to them. So I think sometimes it's even just the thought that counts and the idea that these people are in our thoughts. And sometimes they're not connected to the everyday community in the way that we might be as adults or even the children might be. So we take it for granted. And so that's wonderful. I think that's a really neat project. So that's great.
Just this week we heard there was a study in Harvard that said flowers increase compassion and kindness in people.
Oh,
so I'm pretty excited about that connection.
Yes, that's interesting. I can see that. They're so beautiful, right? So yes. Can you, since you mentioned state testing, can you speak to the positive results of intentional kindness education as it relates to increases in academic achievement? I know that you were at Westwood School for a number of years and that it went through a bit of a rough patch, I think, from about 1998 to 2003. So how did the kindness education that you and your team brought about, how did that improve the culture and the academics of your school?
It was unbelievable because it almost seemed like overnight when we got really intentional with our character education efforts and with empathy and kindness in particular, it seemed like almost overnight test scores just skyrocketed. And we actually had 3 years in a row where our state testing scores in the reading area actually were at 100%. Well, you couldn't get a 100, but you could get a 99. So 99 meant 100. So if you really looked that up, you'd see 99. But it meant that all of the children in that grade level, it was just third grade because that's where testing starts. And we were a pre-K through third.
Sure.
It was unbelievable. It was just unprecedented that every single child would pass a state reading test. And math was pretty up there, too. We still had some gains to make in math. But because we were using empathy to elevate fiction, to elevate empathy, we were weaving in all sorts of, you know, like the letter writing with the Valentines and the caps, the knitting club, they wrote letters to the moms who were going to receive the caps. Every time we integrated curricular with our service learning and that kindness piece, we were not only teaching, you know, the character, the core value, but we were also strengthening the curriculum. And we really saw growth and we really saw mastery because we tied it to absences went way down. We got to a 98.2% gold standard for attendance. Again, because you've made this climate where people, like we had one family say, I almost want to have another kid just so they can come through Westwood. And I know that sounds like Camelot or pie in the sky or something, but it's real.
Wow. Wow. And would you attribute that then to this feeling that everyone not only felt like they belonged to the environment, but also this concept of service and how great it feels to sort of be contributing to an environment like that?
Right. Because again, it comes back. It's such a boomerang. And so it feels good. It feels good to get those letters back and it feels good to honor those veterans. Oh, another one of our programs that I would absolutely say is one of the most important is the first grade veteran program every year. And some veterans will tell us we have never been thanked before. But that gratitude piece is also a huge part of kindness, not just feeling thankful, but showing gratitude. So we tell the kids, don't just feel thankful, do thankful. You know, like how do we do thankful? And one of those is inviting those veterans in and singing for them and talking with them and listening to their stories about when they were in first grade and thanking them. And we do that with grandparents as well, you know, just making those partnerships and inviting those people in. Anytime you can show a kindness is going to come back in kind somehow, some way. And then you just feel that. You feel that in your school. You feel that in your culture.
Absolutely. And since you're talking about gratitude, I think that's a really important piece in terms of how you frame the world and how you see it, because sometimes, you know, difficult things can happen and we all have adversity in one form or another. How has gratitude practice informed the way that you educate children in terms of your own experience with it?
Well, in the year 2013, I actually picked gratitude as my one little word. And 10 days into January, I was hit head on by a drunk driver.
Oh.
And my challenge was going to be gratitude in all things. In fact, I had made 2 Daymaker phone calls moments before I took off that afternoon, because I want to call parents and thank them for the great job that they're doing with their kids. And, you know, for sending them to us. And I had made those phone calls, and then I just was hit head on by this lady who incidentally was on her way to get her child from school.
Oh.
So I found gratitude, like, for sure that I wasn't more gravely injured in a lot of senses of that word, but that I was broken but could recover, and that I was able to learn things like how to forgive and like how to allow people to show kindness to me, because the gift of receiving kindness when you're a caregiver is not always like innate. It's not like a thing. You want to give, and you were taught it's better to give than to receive. And so to be able to receive, when my friend Margaret said, "Hey, let me come over and wash your hair." And I was like, "Oh, no, no, I wanted that, but I didn't know how to receive that." I learned so much, and it taught me to help kids find gratitude even when they're struggling, even when they sit down with me and say, "I'm heartbroken because we're getting a divorce." And it's so sad to hear a fourth grader tell me she's getting a divorce. I still don't know that I'll ever, you know, be able to process that really, really well with them. But by the end of the time when they leave my office, to give them a piece of that hope and say, "Okay, so what are we grateful for today, even though you're struggling with heartbreak?"
That, first of all, thank you for sharing that. What a difficult time that must have been. And I'm so sorry that that happened. And I just find it really interesting that you talk about this giving in terms of sometimes it comes with a judgment a little bit without necessarily meaning to, but people who aren't broken don't need help, right? Is sort of this idea that we have. I had a similar experience where I had a spell of vertigo when I had a 4-month-old and a 2.5-year-old. So it was a really busy time. And I'm a real doer, and I like to give a lot. And I also found receiving help very, very difficult, because I was laid out for, I mean, only about a week, but couldn't do anything, couldn't stand up. And that experience was very, very humbling. And it forced me to reconsider what it means to be helping, a helping person, but also to receive help. And I think in helping, you know, it really has to be free of the judgment that the person, it's hard to put into words, but that idea that person is lesser or something, you know, there's sort of that judgment piece that can accompany kind gestures. And I think what that experience gave me was the insight to go, "Oh no, it's not about sort of deserving it versus the, you know, the other piece." So thank you for sharing that, because I can really identify with that portion.
I think everybody needs a sidekick, really. And so keeping with that superhero theme, you know, who are those sidekicks, and what role do you let them play? Because sometimes it seems like the sidekicks are every bit as sharp and strong as the superheroes, mm-hmm. right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So I guess I want to talk a little bit about resilience, since that's a big part of kindness, I think, on some level, in terms of forgiveness and then bouncing forward, this idea that, you know, adversity happens and we can overcome it and actually be better versions of ourselves if we can look at that adversity as a learning point. And so as educators, that's a really important lesson to teach, but it can be difficult to do so in an effective way. So how have you really built the concept of resilience within students and help them to develop self-talk or strategies that enable them to be more resilient in the face of adversity?
So I do a lot with the kids when I'm working with resilience. Byron Katie's work, She's got a book, a grown-up book called Loving What Is, and I read that a few years ago. And then she's got a children's book that I can use with them called Tiger, Tiger, Is It True? Mm-hmm. And her work is based on the four questions. And I don't want to minimize it because you probably should read the book. But basically, when I read it with the kids, we have to get to the fact that there's some sort of a locked or fixed mindset that's keeping them stuck. If they're trying to move, you know, like to bounce forward, to move into their new normal. And so we want to get to where we can reframe that. I think one of the best reframes I've ever heard is, am I buried or am I planted? Mm. Right? So when we're thinking about growth and being, you know, 6 feet under and feeling like we'll never get to that new normal, it's the same thing, but it's different, right?
Yes.
So when I talk to kids about reframes, like, her four questions basically go along the lines of, like, is that thought true? Can you absolutely know that thought is true? How do you feel when you believe that thought? And then what would your life be without that thought? Mm-hmm. And then we do the turnaround thought, and you have to find three different ways to turn that thought around. You know, so they could have the thought, oh, this is the worst day I've ever had. So you go through the questions and then you see if they can, you know, turn that thought around, because resilience starts with what we're thinking. Actually, everything does, right? Everything begins with a thought.
Absolutely.
And so if you can get them to somehow get rid of that stinking thinking or to turn those thoughts around, they can better unlock those fixed mindsets. This fall, one little boy described it. He's a fourth grade boy, and he said, it's like a traffic jam in your brain.
Yes, it is. Said,
it is. And so how do we wait out the traffic and, you know, and unstuck that, unstick, so we can get going again and find that forward motion after we've been stuck in that horrible traffic?
And I think sometimes it just comes down to developing the skills to look beyond the thought process that you have. Because I think for some children and even adults, you get stuck and you think that that's the only option, that you have no control over it. And so that idea that, well, let's be creative and see if there are other options is such a powerful and empowering message to receive. And for children who are little sponges and they're able to learn so quickly and adapt so quickly, that if that becomes ingrained, that challenge of the assumption that this is my story forever is such a powerful thing for them to learn. So I really appreciate that. You are just nailing my continuum here. So I was about to talk to you about the growth mindset with Carol Dweck, and I would love for you to speak a little bit about that. So, you know, just for the audience. So Carol Dweck has developed the concept of this fixed versus growth mindset. And first of all, can you speak to the difference between the two, and then maybe illuminate a little bit how teachers can develop that growth mindset within themselves? And I know that you have sort of alluded to that within the resilience piece, but how do we cultivate it? And then what are some actionable ways to even model it? And I know, for example, Daniel Pink, who's an author, again, with adult books, who's talked about this, the idea of motivation in the workplace and done a lot of work around that. He talks about praising the process, not the person. And this idea that even when we're trying to be helpful and we say things like, you're so smart, that can actually be damaging. So can you speak to some of that?
Yes. So we read Dweck's book almost right when it came out, and as a book study, and we were just floored. It seemed so simple, but it just was so powerful at the messages that we'd been giving our kids, you know, that whole, oh, you're so smart. Oh my goodness, you are so smart. And I heard it everywhere after I read that book. It's like the blue van, right? I bought a blue van and I was so excited. Like, I'm the only one in Texas who has this blue van because it came from New York and I'm so lucky. And I saw like five of those on my way home that day. And I was like, shoot, I'm not the only one with this blue van. But so it really, for anybody who has not read Mindset, absolutely is one of my recommendations. Carol Dweck kind of said that people are a hybrid of both, which is interesting because I think at first people thought they were either fixed or growth, but you're a hybrid of both. And so you want to nurture that growth so you don't get stuck. She also said that basically those fixed mindsets aren't there to do us harm, but they're just there to protect us. So then it's interesting because you have to look at what do I need protection from? And I love that, you know, maybe I'm just trying to hold on to the past because that's the way we've always done it. Mm-hmm. But the fixed mindset basically believes that our intelligence is innate. Mm-hmm. So I might have, again, that reference to, oh, poor baby, he's doing the best he can, or dogs don't have cats, or, you know, those things where you're like, that's kind of funny, tongue in cheek, but basically that's a really fixed mindset kind of thing, that this kid can't do any better because, you know, of where he came from or who his parents are. Mm-hmm. The growth mindset says, no, we got to champion mistakes and learn from our mistakes. And we are not threatened by other people's success, but we are inspired by other people's success. And in fact, it takes the word fail and puts first attempt in learning, F-A-I-L, on that instead of just, oh, I'm such a failure. I can't make an F because then, you know, the world as I know it is coming to an end, instead of, man, if I made an F, then could I make a D the next time? And
yes.
Then could I make a C? And trying to just use it as growth. And so, she has been pivotal. Her work has been pivotal in helping teachers kind of let kids know that we mess up too, be vulnerable and teach them that there's not always just one way to get to a problem, and help them work together and be inspired by one another, and change that, oh, you're so smart, kind of to like, it looks like you may have worked really hard on that. What were your successes and what were your setbacks along the way? And so a lot of the work I've done with teachers and counselors recently has been kind of in, oh, and parents too, doing some parent workshops in kind of fostering that mindset, because if it's fixed, it's going to lead to perfectionism, and then kids are going to shut down because you just don't have a lot of latitude in how to get to the end. But like you said, with Daniel Pink and focusing on the process, you know, you're focusing on the effort and the process as opposed to some sort of perfect end all. And so that gives you so much more breadth in a project to, you know, go zigzag instead of just straight line, you know, one and done, and what's the next project. It also asks for reflection, because people with a growth mindset want to be better tomorrow than they were today. I think one of my favorite growth mindset quotes is, make tomorrow so great that yesterday gets jealous.
That's great. I don't think I've heard that one. That's great. I love that. I think you're absolutely right, and it's interesting you bring up perfectionism, because again, I did want to talk about that. So, Elizabeth Gilbert is an author who's written a number of books, and in her most recent book, I believe she had a beautiful quote about perfectionism. So she says, "I think perfectionism is just fear in fancy shoes and a mink coat, pretending to be elegant when actually it's just terrified. Because underneath the shiny veneer, perfectionism is saying nothing more than I'm not good enough." Can you speak to the story of your experience, if you don't mind? Talk about vulnerable. As a sixth grader, straight A student, and what it meant to get your first C. Because when I read that, I just thought, oh my gosh, that's me in a nutshell. I think I was very much that type of student, and it was devastating to break that straight A sort of average because of what it represented.
It was devastating. And my one word for 2018 is vulnerability. So I'm glad that you've asked. I don't remember if I share the story, but I actually tried to change that C to a B. And you can't really change a C. Like, you know, we had handwritten report cards, but the B is not as curvy as the C. And so it was so obvious that I had changed, but I was willing to risk being in trouble twice than I was to bring that C home, because that just wasn't going to be acceptable. And that was, man, that was really hard. And it started the fixed mindset that I stink at science. And I ended up marrying a scientist, because to this day, I pretty much don't believe that I can do science. And I've been raising some chemical engineers, so I've tried to understand what a polymer even is. So it's not that I'm closed as much anymore now that I've identified it, but there still is this fear. And the person that you mentioned, Elizabeth, nailed it with the fear piece, because perfectionism totally is fear. And Brené Brown talks about it a lot in her book, The Gift of Imperfection.
And, beautiful
and
book.
Really, oh my gosh. It's yes. Such an eye opener and so spot on. I just was like, I was calling my sister, listen to this. And I'm like reading out loud. It was just so powerful.
It is.
Because she and I both had that same experience.
Yes. Yes.
We were just afraid. It was like walking on eggshells to make a mistake, because we just thought our parents were going to love us more and value us more and appreciate us more if we just did everything perfectly. And I don't even know how we knew what perfect was. And I'm pretty sure it changed from day to day, but it was. It's just walking on eggshells, and you can't trust and you can't fully live. And it's a horrible way to, it's a bad thing to put on a kid. It's a horrible way to try to be healthy. I don't think you can.
I absolutely agree. And I think it comes, you know, with that comes this desire to please, because you're sort of raised in whatever way it is. But with that perfectionist tendency, you sort of look outward instead of doing that healthy striving piece where you're really doing it for yourself. And I think that for me as an adult and as a teacher and even as a mother has been such a fundamental shift in my paradigm of thinking. So instead of sort of gauging everything against how everyone else is feeling, it's really about tuning back into what my purpose is, what my intentions are, what my values are in relation to my family, my practice as a teacher, as a leader in the community, and how empowering and how I think the weight of it kind of just lifts off your shoulders when you're doing it for a more purposeful why, I guess.
I think so too. Yeah, especially as a mom. And we tried so hard not to put perfectionism on our kids. And, you know, of course, the old tapes play, and sometimes you do. And then, but you know what, that people pleasing, oh my gosh, kindness will people please every bit as much as, you know, look at me, I'm a National Merit Scholar or whatever. And I just always told my kids, you know what, just be kind. Just be kind. You know, it'll be great if you're successful, but let's just make sure we're really being kind also.
Absolutely. And how people come away after interactions with you, are they feeling better or worse? And I think that's often a really interesting way of guiding how you interact with people. Before we go to our rapid fire questions, because I want to be mindful of time, I want to talk a little bit about kindness to oneself. So Pema Chodron said, compassion begins with kindness to ourselves. So can you speak to the importance of self-care in the space of giving cultures or giving type professions? It's impossible to give from an empty cup, right? So how can we ensure that our cups are full and that those within the caring professions don't suffer that compassionate burnout? I know that you've developed a program around the B attitudes of self-care. Can you speak a little bit to that?
Well, it's really just a part of mindfulness and being aware, because truthfully, when you burn out and there is just nothing to give, you know, then you start getting resentful and anger builds and you have to stay in front of that. So, you know, I ask people to identify their own B attitudes, but really just the whole idea of well-being with focus on the word B. And how do you get mindful? What does that for you? Mindfulness, basically, you're just asked to be in the moment, to unwrap the present, mindfully aware without judgment. So this year I've just adopted a mantra that's just judge less, love more. And so sometimes it's just as easy as repeating that mantra and just getting still and saying, today I will judge less and love more, because judgment, man, that gets in the way really, really fast of service, of kindness, of empathy. Other things, it's just like your therapeutic resources, like For some people, it's a circular walk. For some people, it's just dedicating some downtime to the people that they love. For some people, it's keeping a gratitude journal. For others, it might be forest bathing. There's all sorts of ways to be mindful, but you have to do those things to replenish. Self-care is not selfish. In fact, it's important in our work. And so it's critical if you're going to be a caregiver that you have a reserve to give. And that's, you know, taking that afternoon walk or that nap or treating yourself to a Starbucks or whatever your, you know, vice is, as long as it's healthy and you can do it in moderation, it's important that you treat yourself kindly so that you can treat others with that same kindness.
That's so beautifully said. And I think it comes down to that acceptance piece, meeting yourself where you're at and not sort of being grounded in these expectations of where you think you should be based on who knows what expectations someone else may have placed on you or you might have placed on yourself. So, no, that's really important. So I guess at this point, we're going to dig into the rapid fire questions. So could you define what kindness means to you?
To me, kindness is the real global warming. It's just being there for somebody in need and lifting that person up until they're warmed with your loving care.
What book or books have you gifted most often to people?
I really like the Bucket Filler series. Have You Filled a Bucket Today is probably the one I've given the most. That really encapsulates kindness for kids and grownups alike.
I love that series as well. What skill or superpower does a teacher need to lead with in order to be effective?
Well, we're back to empathy, compassion, and kindness. I think they just have to be able to accept the kids where they are and just be okay with growth and not some ridiculous standard where they have to take them. If they can grow them, and they've enveloped them in a culture of caring and kindness, then I'm good with that.
I love that. Now, I've asked the same question, but about principles. So what skill or superpower does a principal need to lead with in order to be effective?
Yeah, it's going to be a little bit different because you're now, you know, steering the ship. I'm hoping that a leader is going to be shared leadership minded, that he or she is going to be a servant leader, a risk taker, and someone with an open door policy who says, come on in and tell me more. For certain patients, vulnerable maybe for sure, like real, you know, mm-hmm. I don't need fake. I just need authentic and someone who trusts me and lets me grow as well.
What message or quote would you print on one of those quote cups that are sold in big bookstores that would be read by millions?
Oh, I'm just going to say kindness is one size fits all.
What a gift this has been. Thank you so much for your time. You have so many interesting ideas and the programs that I know that you're putting into effect are wonderful, and I will be sure to link all of the information about your books and your blog and all of that within the show notes. I think that people have a lot to gain from your expertise and your lifelong passion and research into this kindness movement. So I really appreciate you taking the time to share that with us.
Thank you so much. It has been a joy to visit with you. I feel like we could talk all day.
This has been another episode of Kindsight 101, the podcast. For links to resources mentioned in this episode, visit smallactbigimpact.com and click on our podcast and choose this episode number. Now, I'd love to give my audience a heads up about my new book, which will provide ideas, actionable strategies, and inquiry-based approaches to creating a kinder classroom through serving the community. Subscribe to my blog for more information. Now, I would love to hear from you. What's the biggest insight that you gained from this conversation? Head over to our website, smallactbigimpact.com, leave a comment on our podcast page, or tag and connect with us on social media with the hashtag smallactbigimpact to share your inspiring story of kindness. Can't wait to hear from you.